Both the nation and the Commonwealth seem to be reaching agreement on the need for significant police reform. A recent Suffolk University poll found that here in Massachusetts, almost 88% of people support banning chokeholds, for example. And on a national level, a recent AP poll found that more than two-thirds of people surveyed believe we need a clear national standard for police use of force. Yet, police reform has stalled in Congress. Why? Joining us now is Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch. Congressman Lynch, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. Good to join you.
So, Congressman, last week both parties introduced police reform legislation, Democrats in the House, Republicans in the Senate. I mentioned this broad public support that seems to be out there, but both bills also now seem stalled. Why is that?
Well, you know, I think there's a vast difference between the two bills. I could say for our part, the House bill does ban chokeholds that are designed to, you know, stop the oxygen flow to a detainee, and that's very, very important. We have some chokeholds that are authorized in use of force policies across the United States in over 16,000 police departments and sheriff's departments that would not be allowed on the battlefield in Iraq or Afghanistan, because you're not allowed to, deny oxygen to a detainee. And yet we have them, as in Minneapolis. They had one that authorized an officer to use a chokehold to knock out, to render unconscious a detainee, an unarmed detainee. And that's the one that Officer Chauvin used against George Floyd. So, that should not be the case. And so many of these departments have not updated their use of force policies in over 50 years. So we think there's a uniform standard that needs to be implemented.
There are some differences, Congressman, between the two bills. You talked about that, differences in whether or not to limit qualified immunity for police officers, differences in how to treat military equipment going to police. But wouldn't this be a moment where it would make sense to work really hard to try to find something that could pass both houses of Congress?
You would think. However, you know, there's a difference between compromise and surrender. So let's just take the no-knock warrant piece. We basically banned, that was prominent in the death of Breonna Taylor, where they used a no-knock warrant, went in, and ended up shooting her by mistake.
A woman shot in her home in Louisville, Kentucky, just for listeners.
Correct.
Go ahead.
Correct. So the Senate bill says that those no-knock warrants are still valid. They can still be used, but the department has to file a public notice that they have used it after the fact. That's not compromise. That's basically status quo. So some of the things that they want, they've put a bill together, but it really, in large part, leaves no room for negotiation because they want to do nothing, right? They want to keep the status quo. The one area where
but I want to stop you there. I apologize for interrupting you, but I want to stay on that point for a minute, because both Republicans say that Democrats are the ones who actually shut down debate in the Senate. And there are critics saying that it actually works for the Democrats in the fall to not have a bill in place, to have that issue open. You're saying that it benefits the Republicans to maintain the status quo. So how do we... how do we square that?
I'm just saying they're pushing their agenda. I don't know what's going to happen in November. I think we need to do something right now. I think we can't let this moment pass. But just so you know, the Democrats voted against cloture. Cloture stops debate. So the Democrats didn't vote to end debate. They voted to keep it going. In other words,
although that keeps it from going to conference, where Nancy Pelosi, for example, has said she's open to there being negotiation about reconciling the bills.
But they wanted to talk about it, right? So you want to, if you're a member of the Senate, if you're a Democrat, or even if you're a reasonably thoughtful person, you want to vote for that to end debate and send that to a vote? I think that would be abdicating your responsibility, given as you've noted, the widespread support across the country for meaningful reform. They didn't put in meaningful reform. They avoided meaningful reform in their bill. So I give credit to my Senate colleagues that voted against cloture to keep the debate going. We do have a solid bill in the House, but they've got to try to do something that actually would make a difference in the Senate and not just rubber stamp something that does very little. There is one area, however. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. No, because I'm going to shift gears. So please.
Yeah, there is one area over the what is the legal standard to surpass immunity? That's an area where I think there is legitimate debate, and we can sit down and we can try to hammer that out. Where would it afford well-intentioned, thoughtful police officers? What would protect them from liability, but get at those people like Chauvin, who had 17 public complaints against his activity. Get at the bad people, but not exposed good police officers to liability.
Okay, so let's shift gears for a bit. I want to ask you about a letter that you recently sent, head of the Oversight Committee's National Security Panel. You requested materials to look into whether Secretary of State Mike Pompeo misused CIA resources. Today was the deadline or the cutoff for that request, so I just want to ask, have you received the materials you requested, and do you have any updates on that?
No documents yet, unless we received them today. I know today was the deadline, but they've been non-responsive to most of our requests, with some exceptions, so that we have received some documents on the matter generally, but not the ones that would be most helpful.
Okay, and another major story that's reverberating around the country right now is this report that intelligence agencies believe Russia may have offered bounties, essentially, for killing U.S. soldiers. Questions seem to center on how certain we are about that. Who knew what and when? Can you tell us what you know about the situation? And if this intelligence is true, what does that mean for the United States?
Well, first of all, it was included in the president's briefing. He is saying, and others have said, that he did not read the briefing and that he's difficult to provide information to. Short attention span. So he's using the excuse that he did not know about it. This is several months old, however, and the wider question is, why didn't Congress know? Why didn't they inform us? I chair the National Security Subcommittee. Why did they not? Why did our defense officials and intelligence officials inform the Intelligence Committee or my committee about the bounty program? I believe it was actually an intercept by FinCEN or one of our financial agencies that actually uncovered the payment pattern and that sort of tied this whole deal together and provided evidence of the fact of these bounties being paid. So we have a request in. I know a number of committees already have a request in to bring a number of cabinet secretaries forward and also defense and intelligence officials from the Trump administration into a hearing, classified hearing at first, but then the desire is to have public testimony as well.
Before I let you go, all of this obviously is happening during a global pandemic. Massachusetts has good rolling numbers trending in the right direction, but we're also really into the reopening now, and there are a number of southern and western states that are seeing spikes. How well are we doing as a Commonwealth and as a country?
I think we're doing very well as a Commonwealth. I really think that Governor Baker has taken it seriously. I think that we've sort of all pulled together, and we have a great healthcare network and hospital community here. And I really think we benefited from all of that. As far as the country goes, I think we suffer from the problem that the president sees this as a state-by-state issue and wants to give each governor, each state, his ability to deal with this differently. And because the coronavirus doesn't respect state borders, that's problematic. So, we've got this sort of macho thing where people don't want to wear masks and, they want to be defiant in terms of government recommendations and health expert recommendations. But, you know, that's why we're having these problems down in the southern states. Governor DeSantis down in Florida refused to close the beaches and just pretended this didn't exist. Similar situations in other states that opened too early. So those were political decisions. They were not in harmony with the health expert opinions on how to handle this. So hopefully they will take it seriously now and get on board and do what Massachusetts is doing.
And that is Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch. He represents the 8th District. Congressman Lynch, I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Tiziana. Bye now.
So WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins has been listening from Washington and joins us now. Hey there, Kimberly. Kimberly, do I have you?
Yep. Hi there. Can you hear me?
Hi there. I can now. Thanks. So okay. Kimberly, were you able to hear the whole interview with the congressman?
I was, yes.
Great. And let me get your reactions to what he said on what's happening with the police reform bill in the Senate and the House, his assessment of Democrats' choices in the Senate, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of many issues that we have seen in Congress. Even when there is strong public backing for a solution, when there is strong sentiment to get something done about something that's facing a crisis facing the country, it's very, very difficult for that to end up in legislation. And this is an example of that. The Republican plan and the Democrats' plan are far apart, and there's very little space, very little appetite for for a solution to be found because they're so far apart. It's just a tough job. We saw how tough it was to negotiate, for example, a relief for the coronavirus, how many weeks that took, and now we're at the tail end of that relief, and there's no sense that any more will be in sight, and we're facing a pandemic. So it's just showing how partisanship is just makes it very difficult for anything to get done in Congress, even when everybody says they want a solution.
So let's stick with the last half of what you just said, because I did want to ask you, we are at a point where some of the CARES Act money will run out, some of the provisions of that bill. There's been a question mark for a while as to whether Congress is going to pass more stimulus money or take other action. Sounds like, based on what you're hearing in Washington, the answer to that is no.
Yeah, there is no real movement to move forward with another package. And this is at a time when, as you said, the numbers of the pandemic are going in the wrong direction. Today is the last day, for example, small businesses can apply for the Paycheck Protection Act loans. Very soon, the extra boost in unemployment benefits is going to run out. That's going to run out next month. So time is ticking away, but it seems very uncertain what, if any, new round of relief might be on the way.
Kimberly, another big story that you just heard me discuss with the congressman is the report that Russia may have offered bounties, essentially, for killing U.S. soldiers. You heard what he knows. You heard his comments on that. What do you understand from the latest reporting? He said, you know, President Trump denies knowing, but got it in his presidential daily briefing. This has been changing like hour to hour. What's our up to the minute assessment of where we are on this story?
Well, one thing that I can say that Congressman Lynch mentioned is that there is a big appetite here in Washington for hearings to be held to find out exactly what happened. Lawmakers here, particularly Democrats that I've spoken to, said either one of two things happened. Either the president was not told about bounties being put on the heads of U.S. troops and allied troops, or he was told and he did nothing about it. And they said that either is unacceptable. So I think you're going to see hearings being called very soon to bring in folks to explain exactly what happened. This is an issue that certainly isn't going away anytime soon.
We know there were congressional briefings, essentially by party, Republicans yesterday, Democrats today. So two follow-up questions there. One, is that unusual under the circumstances? And two, is there a bipartisan response brewing on this? Is this sort of unacceptable and concerning across parties?
Well, this is certainly something that is very difficult for Republicans to try to defend as the facts about this come out. Having briefings based on party is not something that is unusual in recent years here in Washington, owing back to that partisanship that I was talking about. But in this case, when it's something as fundamental as the lives of active duty troops in Afghanistan being put in danger, it's extremely difficult to draw a partisan line there. So I think definitely there is concern on both sides. And I think once these hearings begin and members of the administration come in, you will hear the concern and the questions being asked from both sides.
Before I let you go, let's talk a little bit about the status of the pandemic in the country. Dr. Anthony Fauci testified in a Senate hearing today. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren questioned him. She asked him about how many more people we may see suffering from the pandemic. And Dr. Fauci said he couldn't predict how many people might die from the virus, but here he is cautioning that infections could rise.
We are now having 40 plus thousand new cases a day. I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around. And so I am very concerned.
Obviously, Kimberly, that is troubling. And we are seeing. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's very troubling. And consider how many of these states there are plans in place to try to return students to schools and to universities and to try to reopen. A lot of these states have had to halt reopening measures. But particularly with schools and other businesses, if they cannot reopen, then that's only going to further depress the economy. And so there is an effort to say, look, we need to get this pandemic under control. The experts that testified today, they were speaking about the fact that measures need to be taken, social distancing, all of the recommendations that came out of the White House task force need to be adhered to very closely, particularly in these states, or there's no way to get a hold of this virus at any point because, you know, a vaccine isn't realistically coming until at least sometime next year. So it's a big problem.
So switching gears one more time, you have covered the Supreme Court. You're watching for the station this week. We're expecting a verdict from the court on these two subpoena cases having to do with the president's financials. Are you hearing any buzz in D.C. about what people are expecting in the results of those cases?
Yeah, the closest kept secret in Washington, D.C. is always what the U.S. Supreme Court will do. And this is probably going to be one of the last decisions that comes out of the court in the days ahead. It's a big issue, not just it won't just decide whether Congress gets a hold of President Trump's financial records, but it also will delineate just how much power Congress has to request this kind of document and to really have oversight over the executive. We saw earlier this week a decision where the Supreme Court really affirmed broad executive authority. This is where the Supreme Court gets to have a say as to just how much power Congress has with its subpoenas. It's a big deal.
Well, we hope to have you back on to talk about it when we find out the answer. That's WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins joining from Washington. Thanks, Kimberly.
Always good to be with you.
Oh, the economic bad news just seems to keep piling up. Encore Boston Harbor Casino says it is furloughing 3,000 employees starting tomorrow. Boston University announced yesterday it will furlough or lay off as many as 250 people to fill a $100 million budget hole. The state unemployment rate stands at 16%, a new record. So how bad is it? Here to help us make sense of that is Evan Horowitz, executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University and a former Boston Globe economics reporter. Evan, welcome back.
Thanks, Cece. I really appreciate you having me.
Glad to have you because I need help making sense of this. Watching these unemployment numbers get steadily worse feels to me like 2008, but I think you say maybe that's not a fair comparison.
I think we all need help because these are very unusual economic times, right? I mean, I think a lot of us have in our heads the 2008 recession as the kind of linchpin for thinking about bad economies or economies that aren't working, but things are very different this time. And the biggest difference is, you know, furloughs are part of the strategy here, right? This is not people being thrown out of work because the economy is bad. It's that public health is in crisis. And the United States decided to respond by allowing massive unemployment, essentially freezing the economy in place, allowing massive unemployment, and subsidizing people through the unemployment insurance system. So basically, in 2007, 2008, 2009, the Great Recession, massive unemployment was a sign that people weren't making money and businesses were failing. Today, unemployment means something different. It means we've put the economy on hold and we're trying to get people money in a different way.
Okay, so you just used that phrase, we're trying to get people money in a different way. Before the break, I was talking to WBUR's Kimberly Atkins, who was saying that it doesn't look like Congress is ready to pass more stimulus. And a lot of that is due to expire. Small business applications run out today. You know, the extended unemployment won't go on for months. So how concerned should we be that we're not going to be able to ride this out even with these strategies, Evan?
So I think deeply concerned. I mean, I think if she's right, if you're right, if the worst fears about the Feds taking their feet off the stimulus gas pedal prove correct, then the economy is going to collapse in a way that we haven't seen yet. Like we've seen huge numbers, right? We've seen record unemployment and joblessness claims and reduced consumer spending, but that was all sort of inevitable because of the disease. And what we haven't seen is a collapse in people's earnings, or at least the money people in people's pockets. People are still getting money. They're just getting it through these kinds of programs, principally through the expanded unemployment insurance program, but also, as you say, through small business loans, through the Fed's support for larger businesses and borrowing. And that's kind of held the economy in this kind of stasis where the numbers look bad, but people's pockets aren't nearly as bad as the numbers would suggest, right? They're still paying rent, believe it or not. People didn't expect to be able to pay rent, but actually the number of people paying rent is close to what it was like before coronavirus hit. So we've managed to create a kind of suspended animation for the economy, but only thanks to federal support. And as I say, if you're right and that federal support is going to disappear, then you'll see the kind of real collapse in people's ability to provide for themselves and their families.
You heard at the top of the segment, I talked about Oncourse, you know, announcing its furloughing of 3,000 employees starting tomorrow. When we look at that number, obviously that's a gut punch of a number. How many of those jobs, I know you can't give an exact number, but how many are jobs that are going to come back in some phase of the reopening? And how many of those are jobs that are not coming back?
So again, a lot of it depends on how well we handle this kind of suspended animation period. If we keep people whole, that is, if we just keep paying people and through unemployment and keeping businesses afloat until we have treatment, then most of those jobs should snap back because there won't be that big a change in demand for gambling. People are going to want to gamble. In fact, people who really miss going out for that kind of entertainment are going to be desperate to do so when there's an effective treatment. That could be a virus or it could be some kind of drug treat, whatever it is. They'll be desperate to do it, so there'll be real demand and those jobs will snap right back. And that's true, I think, for movie theaters, the same thing. Movie theaters are empty. And companies that own movie theaters are facing kind of devastating situation. But once we get the virus under control, people are going to want to go back to the movies, and those businesses can snap back. The problem will be if in the interim we don't keep people whole, we don't pay people sufficiently for not working, which is what we're doing, right? We pay people to not work. If we stop doing that, then even when we have a treatment, people won't have leftover money. They won't have pent-up savings that they can use for a trip to the casino or to the movie theater. So they won't snap back.
I also wonder in listening to you. Well, so you talked about eventually as things come back. In listening to you, I find myself wanting to ask, okay, what kinds of businesses and industries can ride it out? We may not have a vaccine, right, until sometime in 2021. Massachusetts Restaurant Association estimates the pandemic could wipe out 3,600 eateries, roughly 25% of the state's restaurants. So who can ride this out as long as it needs, even assuming the federal government does increase stimulus spending or give more stimulus spending, and who can't?
But with the right amount of stimulus, businesses can ride it out. I mean, that's just it. You know, the businesses are getting paid by the federal government. They can ride it out. It seems crazy. And I think in normal times, of course, it would be crazy to just say, well, stay at home and the federal government will pay you. But these ain't normal times. And whatever the federal government invests now in keeping businesses afloat directly will pay off next year or whenever it is, 10, 12 months from now, 18 months from now, when people can go back, and suddenly they have money to spend and the economy rebounds. Now, it's true that there are limits to how much the federal government can borrow, but the real constraint on federal government borrowing is, will people lend them money? That is, can they borrow? And so far the answer is, oh yeah, they can borrow. In fact, people are giving them money at a loss. Current rates, current yields on bonds, like inflation-adjusted bonds, like of real dollars, people are willing to give the money, give the government a dollar and get back less than a dollar in 10 years. That's how desperate they are to hand the federal government money that the government can then give to businesses and individuals. So there's no real constraint on the federal government doing it. There are severe political constraints. But the government really could keep businesses and families whole throughout this entire period. And if they want the economy to function on the other side of this, that's what they have to do.
All right. Now, before I let you go, let's talk about the state for just a minute. How healthy is the state government's finances, and what else does the state government need to be doing right now to make sure that we can recover as we do sort of science our way through this pandemic?
So the state government is in a very difficult position because, unlike the feds, where I just said the only real constraint on federal borrowing is how much people are willing to lend. That's just not true for state government. The state can only spend as much as it takes in, roughly, in any given year. And obviously, it's not taking in as much in tax revenues because people aren't, so sales taxes are way down, people aren't spending as much. So the state government is in bad shape. Having said that, it's not in as bad shape as it will be if that federal aid goes away. And one way to see this is a large chunk of the tax revenue that the state takes in, it comes right out of your paycheck. You see it as the withholding. Like, you never even get it, right? You get a paycheck, and that money's sort of taken out of it and goes right to the state. And that's held up really well. In fact, the state has gotten more money in withholding last month than it expected to get before the coronavirus started. That is, the projections before this recession. So the state's doing okay on a number of measures because the federal government, again, is paying people. Like, it trickles right into the state coffers. Mm. And the state also will suffer if that goes away, and we'll see some of the kind of more dire circumstances. The other plus, I think, for the state is we are starting to see some rebound in consumer spending. The kind of real-time data suggests consumer spending is down about 10%. That's bad, but not cataclysmic.
All right. That's helpful picture, Evan. Thank you so much. Evan Horowitz, Executive Director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University and a former Boston Globe economics reporter. Thanks.
Thank you, Tiziana.
June is Pride Month, and it was already set to be a Pride Month like no other in the face of the coronavirus pandemic. But then in New England and across the nation, people took to the streets to protest against racism and police brutality. The protests are exposing both tensions and solidarity in the movements for civil rights for Black and LGBTQ people. For many non-Black LGBTQ people, the moment has led to demands for them to stand up as allies against racial injustice. For those who find themselves at the intersection of two identities, being Black and a member of the LGBTQ community, it has marked the ongoing fight for inclusion and representation in every part of their lives. So we want to spend the rest of the hour exploring the intersection between LGBTQ activism and Black Lives Matter as Pride Month comes to a close. Call us. How have you been reflecting on the relationship between the movements? How do you feel Boston has handled it? Are you an ally wondering how you can support those two communities? Do you have a personal experience of intersectionality that you want to share? We want to hear all of it. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So two guests are joining us to have this conversation. First, we have Athena Vaughn, president and chair of Trans Resistance Massachusetts, which organized this month's Trans Resistance Vigil in March. Welcome to Radio Boston, Athena.
Happy to be here.
And also with us is Casey Dooley, a local LGBTQ activist and former chair of Boston Pride's Black and Latinx Committee. Welcome to Radio Boston, Casey.
Hello. Thank you very much for letting us have this conversation.
Very happy to have you. Athena, I'll start with you, and I just want to ask you, how have you been reflecting on the intersection of Pride and Black Lives Matter this month?
Reflection-wise, I have been doing my best to create space and have conversations with individuals and allow people to inbox, text, or call just to be able to express what they think, how they feel, what they would like to see, and stuff like that.
And Casey, how about you? How do the two intersect for you? And how do you talk about with other people the reality of being a Black LGBTQ woman?
You know, I think it's so important for us to continue to have these conversations with people, you know, to just keep this in the spotlight. And just in case no one, you know, in case people have forgotten, the LGBTQ movement was started by Marsha P. Johnson, which is a trans woman of color, against police brutality within the community. And if it wasn't for her and many others, we wouldn't be allowed to sit back and question and wait to discuss this. So I just want to bring it back to that.
Pride Month is usually celebrated with parades. This month, it was more about protests, other demonstrations. Obviously, sort of major formal parades, gatherings, festivals had been canceled because of the pandemic. But you were both involved with the Trans Resistance Vigil and March that was held in Franklin Park this month. How did it feel to be standing up and speaking out in that setting instead of something like the annual Boston Pride Parade?
I think that it was for me personally speaking, it was better to do because it was to bring back the remembrance of what Pride really meant and how it first started. Many people don't know, and some do know, that the reason why Pride was started was a resilience and a fight back against the police brutality that was going on against the LGBTQ community, trans women especially, and gender nonconforming individuals in general. And so, for when Boston Pride put out their statement and it seemed like they were in solidarity with the men in blue, it just took us back, because we see everything that's going on in the world with Black Lives Matter and with Black trans lives. And instead of an entity that was created for our community standing with us, it seemed like it stood with the injustice that was going on in the world. And it was like a slap in the face to our ancestors and to those who fought and marched and went through all of that just to get to where we're at, just for you all to basically hand them dookie on a stick. It was like a slap in the face. It was an injustice to us all over again for an entity that was created for us by us.
So I want to give some context there, Casey, to some of what Athena just said. There was controversy over Boston Pride's stance on Black Lives Matter. This month, the organization released an initial statement addressing anti-racism protests. The final version of which the board put out didn't consult Black and Latinx Pride Committee, which at the time you were the chair. The statement did not include the phrase Black Lives Matter. I know that you've since resigned from your position as the chair of that committee. Where do you stand with Boston Pride right now?
I do not stand with Boston Pride. I stand with the QTPOC community and working together to really form an alliance and a coalition to move forward and be what we want Boston Pride, you know, what Boston Pride wasn't. And just hopefully in the future, the organization will be transparent and democratic. But for right now, I think we need to continue to push forward. And some of the other volunteers that resigned, we put together Boston Pride for the Community, which we are going to continue to call for the resignation of the board. And if anyone wants...
Oops, I think we lost you for a second there, Casey. Do we have Casey? Okay, I'm sure we will get Casey back, and when we do, we'll invite Casey to tell us the rest of that thought. Athena, in a minute, I want to turn to calls. We do have calls on the line, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You know, at the beginning, I asked the two of you a couple of questions, Athena, and I asked Casey about Casey's experience with the reality of being a Black LGBTQ woman. Let me ask you the same question and how you have thought about that in these last couple of months as the country has turned its attention to Black Lives Matter in a way many have hungered for years.
Can you repeat the last part again? How does it make me feel? I just want to be sure I'm answering correctly.
I just want to give you an opportunity to talk about how you're experiencing the intersectionality of your identity in a moment where the country is coming awake to the Black Lives Matter movement in a way that the movement has fought to get the country to pay attention for a number of years now?
So for me, it is, I've always, so when I first heard about what happened with Boston Pride, I said to myself, I was reached out to, and they asked me if I would do a video for them, sending solidarity basically with them as well as for the Boston flag raising. And I said, I'll do a video for the flag raising, but I will not stand and be standing in solidarity with you all because what you all did was not right. And so I recorded a 4-minute video, and the 4-minute video, you know, talks about everything that we've gone through and as a people being Black and being trans and where we've come from and how far we still have yet to go and how we have people who claim to want to speak up for us, who claim to want to have a voice for us and claim to want to fight for us. But then when the time to do so comes, everyone scatters and hides. So I said, you know, it is time for Black trans excellence to lead for itself. We have leaders and we have powerful speakers and we have smart individuals and beautiful individuals who can actually stand up and speak for ourselves. And so that is how trans resistance was born, because it was time out for allowing everyone to speak for us and then not speaking our full truth. It was time out for everyone to be telling us that they were going to fight and stand for us, and then there's no one standing and fighting for us. And so we decided to come together as a community, and we were going to fight for ourselves and to remind people what Pride was all about. It was not about just a celebration. It was not just about song and dance. It was not just about staying in a park and waving flags, but it was actually a resilience and a resistance against what was going on against us in a community. So it's one of those things where it's hardening, because On one side, we're being talked about, but on the other side, we're not being talked about. And the people who should be talking about us aren't talking about us. And we're all, again, as usual, often overlooked and bypassed when it comes to us. But when they say Black Lives Matter, you're understanding that the word Black Lives means Black first. So I'm Black first, and then I'm trans second. And so that means I matter with everyone else that matters. But sometimes that's not reciprocated when it comes to talking about what's going on in this world.
Athena, we have Casey back, and I also want to bring a call in here. I'm going to grab a call from Jesse in Cambridge, and then we'll bring Casey back into the conversation as well. Jesse, go ahead.
Hello, Tiziana. You're a wonderful, well-informed, respectful host, and I love your show.
Thanks.
So,
thanks,
I would
Jesse.
Like you to know, and also listeners know, that there's an annual event where gender nonconforming people remember those who have been killed. Their names are spoken. Their pictures are shown. We gather. We have food together. Their names are spoken. And sometimes I've been at a smaller one where the actual nature of the murder is briefly described, and I can only say there, many of the killings are horrific, absolutely horrific. I've rarely, if ever, heard about any of them in the news. I don't know what else to say about that, except that Pride for me has been great for what it is, and it isn't what it was. And when I showed up and jumped in the parade 4 years ago and felt like free and really out there in public and felt wonderful, within 36 hours, there was the massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Florida. So both are part of our experience. And I guess that's all I want to say. I don't want to take up a lot of time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Jesse. And I'm going to give both Casey and Athena an opportunity to react there. Casey, welcome back.
Thank you.
And I really do want to hear both of your reactions to Jesse's call there. Since we lost you for a little while, Casey, let me give you a chance to go first.
Thank you. I'm really not sure what the question was in there.
I think Jesse just really wanted to share some of his experience, remind people of the level of violence that both the trans community and the Black trans community experiences in the United States, and to talk about how important it is to be recognizing the intersectionality of identity here. I didn't know if any of that resonated or if there was anything you wanted to build on from there.
You know, one way that we can support is
Okay, I think we may have lost Casey again. We may just be having trouble with Casey's line. Athena, let me turn to you.
I think that what they talked about is amazing, and I think that it could be an amazing event. Please find Trans Resistance Math on Facebook and send us the information. We can try to send some representatives to come out and support, as well as one way that you can support us, as everyone knows, and we've been saying that Trans Resistance Massachusetts is creating its own pride for us, by us, next year for 2020. And we need all help that we can get, whether it's donations, financial donations, whether it's donating your time or space for us to meet, whatever it may be. We are open to accepting whatever it is that people would like to help. We know that from our vigil in March that we had from this past year, from this past couple of weeks, it was over 2,500 people is reporting that came. And so we're looking to have that same support as we launch our own Pride next year, to be marching from the police station down in Nubian Square to march back up to Franklin Park to actually have a celebration after. So as we prepare for that, we say something in my own family. We used to say something in church growing up, and it's just be brethren and sisterin for one for another. So as we wipe your back and you wipe our foreheads, we're just there for each other. And as I've been saying, it takes a village to raise a community or a child. So we just have to be supportive of one another as we're fighting what's going on in this world currently.
Let's bring Casey back again. Casey, I think we have you on a different line this time.
Yes. Sorry, my computer, I think I need a new one.
That's okay. Casey, part of what Athena was just talking about was plans for next year, how marching will be different, how protests will be different. In reading and preparing for this segment, one of the things that really struck me was the extent to which there seems to be a sense that mainstream Boston Pride, that the LGBTQ movement has been historically a more white movement. Not obviously at the beginning. We know about Marsha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera, Miss Major Griffin Gracie, but that there has been a movement into more of a white leadership in the LGBTQ movement. We're having larger conversations about emerging Black leadership across the country here in our own city. How do we think about this moment in terms of transfers of leadership, new approaches, disruption? I'd love to hear you reflect on that.
I mean, now is the time for change. And historically across the country, many of the Pride boards are white, and you know, there's not really much is lacking their diversity. So now is the time to change it. You know, the Center for Black Equity, which is the head of all of the Black Prides, which there's 47 in the country and 10 outside of the country, are doing some amazing work, and they supported and signed on to the Boston Pride Volunteers demand letter to the board asking for change. And I think it really speaks volumes when we hear nothing but silence from World Pride, from Inter Pride, from all these other Pride organizations that need to be standing with us, right beside us. Their silence is deafening. So I think that we need to have these conversations within our communities with all of our small Pride organizations and ask them, how are you supporting the QTPOC community? What are you doing to help? Are you using your voice? Are you funding? How can we be better allies and help?
Let's go back to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Anne on the line from Somerville. Anne, go ahead.
Hi, Tatiana. Thanks for having me on. So I really appreciate this discussion, and it's very moving to hear people's testimony about the experience. So I'm straight, white, and I would say integrationist by nature, but I'm also interested in progressive political strategy. And I think historically, one of my big frustrations with where things have gone in this country is that, in my view, as someone on the progressive side, people tend to try to push for too much too quickly without looking at the lay of the land politically. So the voting majority in this country is white. You know, more people of color need to come out and vote, but that's been a problem for decades. And it's given
and
us
I'm gonna have
punitive.
To have you finish up the point, just because we're getting really close on time.
So I would just ask the guests to think about how they could be part of moving forward strategically and not get too caught in the weeds with, you know, sort of demanding instant loyalty, you know, and prioritization of their cause when we're just trying to get Black lives to be protected in this country. Start there, because that's been a 400-year struggle.
Thanks, Anne. Let me take it back. Thanks. So we've got only a couple minutes left. I'm sorry I don't have more time for the two of you to react. I would like to invite either Casey or Athena to respond to Anne's call.
Athena.
I she said a lot. So, I'm not a political person, but that does not mean the trans resistance is not able to get into politics itself. But me, personally, I'm not a political person. But that doesn't mean things can't change for the future. I believe that in order for voices to be heard, we need voices everywhere in this world. Doesn't matter the field, doesn't matter the place, doesn't matter the time. We just need our voices in those places, at those tables, and at those and seats at those tables, so that we can be heard.
Thank you. And Casey, I'll give last word to you in our last minute or so.
I know something that I am very passionate about is getting people registered to vote, because, you know, we can make our voice heard by voting. And I know that's something that we're also going to incorporate in any of the future projects with the, I know, Boston Pride for the People, I believe, Athena, the Trans Resistance, and Black Pride.
And so that's Casey Dooley. No, that was great. Casey Dooley, local LGBTQ activist. I really appreciate your time and your sharing today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
And Athena Vaughn, president and chair of Trans Resistance Massachusetts. Athena, thanks to you, too. I really appreciate your time and your sharing.
Happy to be here.